Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT. Bandwidth for Triangulation is brought to you by CacheFly at CacheFly.com. This is Triangulation, episode 353, recorded Friday, June 29th, 2018. Anti-social media. It's time for Triangulation, the show where we get together with some of the most interesting people in technology, pick their brains for an hour. Today, it's going to live up to its name. When we first started doing Triangulation, it was John C. Dvorak's idea. It was going to be a three-legged stool, a triangle, where we interview, pick on, if you will, a third person. The first victim was Larry Lessig, but John swiftly abandoned the show and left me to my own devices. So we've always said that the third leg of the stool in this show is the chat room. But today we actually have a triumvirate, and I'm so thrilled. First, let's introduce our guest, who will be new to some of you, not to all of you. Siva Vaidyanathan is a professor of media studies at the University of Virginia and author of a book called Anti-Social Media, How Facebook Disconnects Us and Undermines Democracy. Just came out a week ago. And I'll let Siva describe it, but it is a screed against Facebook, I guess, is probably the best way to describe it. We're not just alone, because I thought I need some ammunition, and I thought this would be a kind of a great opportunity to bring in the king of techno panic himself, the professor of he's reading the book right now, the professor of journalism at the City University of New York, Jeff Jarvis. He's, of course, a co-host with us on Twig at Blogs at BuzzFeed, has written a few of his own books, including Public Parts and What Would Google Do. Jeff, Siva, welcome. I know you guys know each other well. In fact, yeah, we've been on shows
great
together.
Great to be back.
Yeah.
In fact, can I just begin with a disclosure and a compliment?
Yes.
Disclosure is that my school accepted money from Facebook to start the News Integrity Initiative, but I am independent of them, as I hope I'll demonstrate. And second, I have no more favorite sparring partner in the earth, and I mean this, than Siva. Siva is always smart and rational and reasoned. He's sometimes wrong, but often right. And I could imagine nothing better to aspire to. So I'm honored to be here with you, Siva. I got the book, and I'm dashing through, and I've read about a quarter of it. And as always, it's wonderfully written, and everyone out there should buy it and then argue with it.
And yeah, well reasoned. Yeah.
I hope so.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, I can't disagree that it's a screed, although screed might imply that it's a bit unhinged. I hope it's still hinged.
It's a hinged screed.
But it was written passionately.
Yeah.
And I'm still deeply immersed. I think it's a story of a heartbreak, right? I think it's a story of good intentions gone terribly wrong. Ultimately, I think what I hope you take away from the book is that Facebook was designed for a better species than ours, and we have not lived up, and we probably can't live up to the design of Facebook, the notion that such a rich level of connectivity, such a process of algorithmic amplification, and this really powerful and effective and efficient advertising system that has, you know, altered so many different areas of life, is just not something that we were prepared to behave well with, right? We're a huge species, and there are 2.2 billion of us operating on Facebook regularly. A good number of that 2.2 billion people are pretty bad people. And a good number of those people have figured out ways to hijack Facebook, yeah, and use it in very destructive ways, spread garbage in ways that get amplified. and target garbage in ways that hit very sensitive groups and people. It's not a story that's unfamiliar to anybody who watches this, right? It's not a story to anybody who's familiar with breaking news in the past year and a half. What I tried to do was dig a bit deeper into the ideologies and the ideas and the histories beneath it. What I failed to do ultimately is come up with a roadmap forward that I believe in.
We're all struggling with that a little bit.
Yeah.
Before we get to, first of all, a couple of things. This is not going to be a traditional, you know, forensics debate, although I understand Jeff just back from Aspen, where he did in fact engage in a debate on this subject.
And lost badly.
Badly or no?
Badly. Yeah, badly.
Jeff, I'm sorry.
What was the proposition?
You had a good team. You should have been able to.
No, you should have been on the team. If you were on the opposite team, I would have lost worse, but it would have been fun.
What was the proposition?
Proposition was social media is good for democracy.
Well, okay. Well, this says undermines democracy, so we know which side.
Footnote, yeah. Vidy enough in 2018.
Yeah.
Right.
So, but also, and in a more serious note, yesterday, of course, in some ways, this is ripped straight from the headlines because, of course, yesterday there was yet another shooting, sad to say, in a newsroom at a newspaper. And there is a Facebook connection to this because the grudge that the fellow had against the newspaper goes back to using Facebook to harass somebody, being prosecuted for that, and the newspaper reporting on it. So there, as you said, ripped from the headlines, Siva. This is there's plenty, and you start the book with plenty of examples of how Facebook has been problematic for years. But Jeff, I know you also have many examples of how Facebook does achieve in some respects.
Well, and Siva does, you know, because he is a fair man, he lists those things. I guess my first question for you, Siva, is that it seems, I had to write a book chapter recently. I don't have the attention span to write the whole book, just a chapter. As I was thinking it through, I realized that I think that our problem is with us. It's with human behavior on technology rather than the technology itself. Aren't you more disappointed in your fellow man and woman than you are with Facebook's dashed dreams?
So two things about that. One, I don't think it's an either-or situation. Technologies are extensions of ourselves, as McLuhan reminded us. Technologies are not distinct from societies, cultures, and practices. They represent embedded values of the designers. And when they're out in the world, they represent and amplify and alter and are altered by our behaviors, everyday behaviors, right? So that's important to remember. It's never an either-or thing between human beings and technologies. After all, Facebook is full of human beings, right? It's human beings wrote the code. Human beings came up with the interface. Human beings designed the whole system and outlined its purpose in the world, right? And sort of launched it and promoted it, right? So human hands touched every single part of it. Human minds inspired all of it. So that's one thing. But am I more disappointed in us than I am in Facebook? Well, that's a function of expectations or a question of expectations, right? I think after the last century that we've had and certainly the last few years, I don't have high expectations for our species, right? I'm going to move this a little bit. I don't have high expectations for our species. I think that holding societies together so we don't all start beating each other up is a hard thing to do and requires constant vigilance. Processes, norms, beliefs, morals, rules, laws, and institutions that we believe in. And for a variety of reasons that precede Facebook, we have seen the erosion a lot of those norms and institutions around the world. In fact, I think the United States so far has gotten off fairly easy. We're not in as bad a situation as the Philippines or Turkey, right? No, it's like after this week, I'm just like, I can't even begin. But So yes, absolutely. But so I'm not so disappointed in our species because I know what we can do to each other. And here's one of the lessons of my book is I don't think that Mark Zuckerberg really conceived of the variety of cruelties that human beings were capable of and
yes,
the ways
true.
In which that Agreed. The ways in which that human beings would quickly glom on to this powerful communicative service toward those ends.
So that does beg the question, and kind of to a restatement of what you were saying, Jeff, is that maybe Facebook just holds a mirror up to us. Maybe it's like the ugly man complaining that the mirror is showing an ugly person instead of why do we blame the mirror?
They do try to argue that. So does media. But I argue back, and I argued back to Google after the election. Your mirror may be straight and true, but this I think Steve and I will agree about. But society cracked itself because you're there. Society warped itself to exploit what the weaknesses in your system. Maybe not all of society. Some number of bad actors right. who ruined it for everybody else.
Yeah, certainly. I mean, certainly not everybody uses Facebook is malicious or malign, and many of the uses of Facebook are beneficial. And as you say, Siva, list them in the book. You had an advantage, Siva, because you were able to read what you call, I don't know if it's the official name, the Zuckerberg files.
Right.
Which allowed you, how many, hundreds and hundreds of pages of public speeches and writings from Mark Zuckerberg, which I think gives you an insight into his intentions.
It's certainly a funhouse mirror of Mark Zuckerberg's statements. It's all his public statements, right? So a really brilliant scholar at the University of Wisconsin at Milwaukee in the library school there a number of years ago started compiling the Zuckerberg files. He and some graduate students started copying videos of his interviews, transcripts of his interviews, and all of his public statements and publications, and then indexing them, by date and subject in a way a librarian would. And if you want to do research with the Zuckerberg files, you send a letter, you send an email explaining what your research project is, and you get a password and you get into it. So I spent many weeks going through statements. For a while, I was just foraging. I was just like zipping back and forth in different areas. And it was so daunting because he said so much publicly.
Although from the outside, it looks as if he's been fairly consistent in his.
Oh, totally. That's the thing. He's a very disciplined person.
Yeah.
So, and I'm not sure, in a lot of cases, when you deal with a corporate leader who is consistent, you think it's a matter of like media training. But in his case, I actually think he's a very consistent and systematic thinker.
Yeah.
And he's a very disciplined person. So that's the thing I got. He doesn't slip up. And he's a deeply sincere person. So I noticed like themes and consistencies across the statements that he was making. And from that, I felt safe pulling out a sense of what he wanted for his company and what he saw in the world. Now, of course, I would have preferred if he had given me 8 hours, but that wasn't going to happen.
Did you talk to him at all about this book?
No, I didn't talk to anyone at Facebook, and that's not unusual. Steve Levy is embedded at Facebook currently, and he basically has exclusive access to in-depth book level reporting. I'm not a reporter, and my position with the same thing I did with the Googleization of everything when Steve Levy was embedded at Google is that I'll let him talk to the engineers and tell the stories of how they make decisions about their products and what rolls out. He does such a brilliant job with that. And I'll step back and try to put it in historical context. And,
as an academic.
So that's really my value. And so, my book is not in any way a replacement for a narrative of Facebook. And I can't wait for Steve Levy's book on the last 2 years of Facebook. Oh my God, what a great book that's going to be. Just to see how these internal debates went down, right? Given all of the various things that have gone on. But I'm not prepared to do that kind of book. My book is very much a step back and a big picture book. That was my approach. I'm just really happy that I was able to get that sort of easily accessible sense of Zuckerberg. And in many cases, I was trying to rely on the scholarship about Facebook around the world. There's been a really great social science work on how Facebook has affected people's daily lives around the world. And that's the sort of stuff that I also have access to because I know that community very well. And I was frustrated that journalists and the big movers and shakers in Silicon Valley have been ignoring social media scholarship for a decade now. Nothing that broke since the fall of 2016, nothing about fake news, nothing about Cambridge Analytica, nothing about any of these other big crises that have put, you know, the genocide, you know, stuff in Myanmar and Sri Lanka. None of that was a surprise to anybody who's been following the scholarship on social media. I mean, people have been, scholars have been on the ground in countries around the world looking at the ways in which social media is being used and abused by nationalist groups, by authoritarian leaders. You know, journalists don't tend to follow scholarship. So it was really hard to get people to pay attention.
That's for damn sure.
So I really sort of, you know, dug it out. Yeah, you know, I mean, once it all broke in the news, it became obvious. But I mean, I started this book long before any of these news stories broke. I just like got caught up in this wave. Like all of a sudden, everything I was typing, the next day I would open the paper and there'd be a story in, you know, in the Times or the Guardian that exemplified a lot of what I was talking about. And all it was really missing was depth. And I kept tweeting to these reporters like, you need to talk to Katie Pierce at the University of Washington, who has done ethnography in Azerbaijan about the use of social media there, you know, and like trying to connect reporters to the scholars who knew this stuff and were never surprised by this stuff. And it's a long haul. But you know, it's just one of those duties I think I have. I'm fortunate among social media scholars that I have a public voice and a public face. And so I try my best to connect interested people to the work of people like Katie Pierce and Michael Zimmer at University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee.
Siva, as a bit of a sidebar here, I'm curious what you think of, because I publicly begged Facebook to give data and open up data to researchers so we could learn more. And they said when they finally did come up with a plan for it, but it's a controlled plan with external funding for the audience's sake and a committee of researchers who will have tremendous access allegedly to Facebook data, but will not rate themselves, will put out RFPs, which is kind of a reverse. What I would wish, the researchers would come in with their questions rather than being told, oh, there's something good over here. But Facebook says they're going to open up. What do you think about that structure?
Given how opaque Facebook has been since its founding, how secretive it's been and how uninterested Facebook was in external research and external criticism, I think that this new plan, which is being laid out by the Social Science Research Council, you know, an esteemed group of scholars or scholarly organization that's been very important in social science since the 1930s, that this plan is a major improvement over the status quo. But as you pointed out, Jeff, I think it's insufficient. It's just, you know, we can't expect Facebook to make more than baby steps at this point. Everything is so hunkered down at Facebook. They're in such a bunker for obvious reasons. They both want to show good faith effort, and they sincerely understand that they have misunderstood their own service and its effects on the world. So they would like there to be scholarship, but they don't want, and I don't think this is a justified position, but they clearly don't want just anybody foraging in their data for a couple of reasons. One, just anybody, as we saw with Cambridge Analytica, can take and misuse that data and it ends up in some other company's hands, right? And can be terribly misused. Or it can, if it's political data, that could end up in some political movement's hands. I mean, there are some worst case scenarios with that as well, right? Mm-hmm. So they do want to keep the community of scholars that are working on these issues fairly limited. And I get that for now. So what I hope is that this experiment, which is largely being run through the SSRC, where SSRC is screening the scholars who want to use the data, and the research is limited to the effect of Facebook on politics.
And in the future, not the past, by the way. That's the other disturbing thing about it. Nothing past.
So I'm just my optimistic hope is that this is a pilot project, a proof of concept that gives Facebook some sort of confidence going forward to be a little bit more open about what it
and see the benefit to them. too.
Yeah. So it's going to take, I mean, I'm crossing my fingers and I'm giving my blessing to the SSRC on this, and my, you know, I have to say something of a blessing to Facebook, only in the sense that, you know, they've been worse. But a lot of my colleagues in the Association for Internet Research are extremely cynical about this for good reason, because they've just been mistreated by Facebook for years and ignored by Facebook for years. So I think that we need, you know, I want to see this experiment roll out. I want to see some good scholarship come from it. I want everybody to sort of chill and relax a little bit about it and see if we can get better scholarship. Because we all know that Facebook, with its internal data, has about as rich an understanding of how human beings react to certain stimuli and situations. You know, like, it is dream data for everybody in sociology, for everybody in communication media studies. It's dream data. They're never going to open it all up to us. But there may be ways, with good faith on both sides, to get a better sense of Facebook's effect on the world.
You know, I was talking to somebody about these kinds of issues not that long ago, and one of my frustrations is that I think that Facebook almost thinks it's done. You know, we know what Facebook is. We know how people behave there. We know a lot about people. Well, no, you know about that in the I think it's an infant technology on an infant platform, the internet. And you know, given the very limited things that are engineered into how that operates. So I think there's a danger of a hubris inside Facebook that they think they know people well. No, they know people on Facebook pretty well and not well enough.
Right. Yeah, good point. Exactly. I hadn't really thought about it in those terms. That makes a lot of sense. Yeah. So, I mean, there's a tremendous amount of hubris at Facebook. I think less this year than last year, certainly, which makes sense, right? And a sense of omniscience, right? That they do have this rich pile of data. But as you said, it's in a particular situation under certain circumstances. And it's improper to extrapolate to larger conclusions, which is why responsible social scientists would hopefully handle that data well and handle those sort of conclusions well. But you're absolutely right about that. And I do think that one of the things that really struck me is the extent to which Facebook and its research team and its engineering team are very concerned with the sort of quantification of happiness, which is a fascinating subject within psychology and even economics, right? This hedonics movement where people are asked to score their relative state of being, and then there'll be sort of self-reported surveys, and then we'll get these studies saying, you know, the Norwegians are the happiest people in the world, right? Or Americans are less happy now than they were 20 years ago, right? When in fact that whole idea, it's like measuring people's height by asking them if they feel tall. It's not actually something you can measure numerically through self-reported moments. There are so many other variables and cultural questions in mind. It's very unscientific, and yet it's central to how Facebook makes judgments about design. If it makes a design choice, either algorithmically or in terms of the interface, and it starts seeing a change in behavior on Facebook that it interprets as a darkening of moods or a dissatisfaction with the world, it sees that as a direct cause and effect, and then it tries to change. So when we saw this big announcement in December that was sort of a reflection of the time well spent campaign and a reflection of what Zuckerberg calls meaningful engagement. A lot of it was based on that sort of feedback, like, oh, when people are sharing stuff about politics, they tend to get grumpy. Well, no kidding, right? You know, like, look around, right? But when they share stuff about puppies, they tend to be happy, right? So the conclusion was that they would try to get meaningful engagement, which means the most person-to-person interaction would be favored and would be amplified. The perverse result of that, of course, is that a lot of posts about the worst things in the world get huge strings of comments, right? Because if I were to post something about how I really think that it's a good thing that kids are getting ripped out of their mother's arms, you know, because they just don't, you know, whatever, justification, right? If I were to post something like that, believe me, I would get 200 comments tomorrow. And then my crazy rant would suddenly end up all over Facebook because people would be quoting it saying, look at this crazy guy. And my friends would be saying, what's wrong with you? And all that negative reaction would actually amplify my crazy message.
Exactly.
So we've got this algorithm. And this is why I wanted to sort of, I want to very much push back on this idea of a mirror or even a flat mirror, because neither Facebook nor Google are, because they are, they have algorithmic amplification. So, so the algorithms are not flat. They favor certain behaviors and certain responses. And that creates a, there are biases embedded in that. They're not biases as we classically understand, as Fox News would say is a bias, but biases toward and against certain sorts of behaviors and interactions. And as a result, what we have is nothing like a flat plane of glass. In fact, nothing like a previous version of internet communication, which I thought was actually quite healthy and diverse. And it was much more flat, which if you think about how we interacted with each other and engaged politically between about 2002 and 2007.
The old days of blogs, huh?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, we love blogs.
So we had, like, if Jeff's blog would link to four other blogs, some of which he agreed with, some of which he didn't. He would criticize people with links. And if you go to Jeff's blog, all of a sudden you're involved in a lattice of conversation, and the power of recommendation is a function of Jeff's reputation rather than some algorithmic choice made at a 3 degrees of distance by some engineer.
You talk in the book about, you know, quote Cory Doctorow, who says Facebook's basically a Skinner box, an operant conditioning machine. But I think, as you've described it, it's more like, to use a technological term, an amplifier. It's more like a feedback loop that stuff goes in, gets amplified, fed back, and then continues and becomes worse and worse and worse. So I guess in that respect, it isn't a mirror.
In the macro, it's an amplifier, right? In the micro, and what Cory was talking about is what our interaction with it is. Like, so I, you know, it's so weird, like in our personal relationship, like if the three of us were hanging out in a bar and, or like right now, like we're talking, we're joking around, we're making comments. If you like something I say, or you think something I said is funny, you'll give me a reaction that I can sense, you know, a laugh, a smile, whatever. And if you do something I say, you will, through body language or vocalization, the same thing, I'll get feedback, but I'll never get a scoreboard. You know, I'll never see, oh, after 3 hours with Leo and Jeff, Siva got 13 smiley faces. You know, like there's no gamification of our personal relationship. But through Facebook, there constantly is. So if I say something I think is funny or I think is profound and I put it on Facebook, the rest of the day I'm looking back like, did I get more likes? Did I get more smiley faces? Do people share it? Do they like me? And what is my score?
Well, so but that, isn't that just a more...
That's what I mean by the Skinner, because it's affirmation, you know?
But it's a more overt version of something that we do anyway. I mean, the whole process of our lives for many people is gathering those likes and optimizing for likes. How is Facebook
different?
Sure, but you
can't count, like... But it's different when you have scores, because you... Then you have a numerical attachment, and there's a learning feedback in there. So we learn, whether we articulate it or not, what to do to get the food pellet.
That's the Skinner box.
So if there's a certain tone or an edginess that over time I've found generates the most reaction, I'm going to start optimizing my expressions with that tone, right?
And which was true on blogs, too.
Best.
Yeah, it just wasn't as rapid or as complete. I mean, I think we understand that Facebook is engineered to encourage stickiness and engagement. And so its designers and engineers are optimizing in that way. Is it your sense that this was intentional, that they're conscious of this and that they're conscious of the downsides of this?
I think it was intentional, well, clearly intentional, but without a consideration of the negative externalities or the negative processes of training us to be good rats in the cage.
But should they, should they be doing that? Is that their responsibility to?
Well, that's a good question. So I actually don't think it's their responsibility. And this is a conversation Jeff and I have been having for a long time. Yes. I actually think that Facebook Google, Exxon, their job is to maximize revenue and return value to shareholders.
And they're very good at it.
And they're good at it, but the folks who run Google, the folks who run Facebook, let's put Exxon to the side because they're right. They believe that they have a higher mission, right? They believe right. that they are there to make the world better. And they're very clear about that, right? They've never, and they've always said, like, the money we make is to enable us to do good things for the world, right?
And you believe that's sincere.
I believe it's sincere, and I also think it's unfortunate. I think we'd be better off if they didn't
if they're
truly
more like
believe
Exxon.
That. And yeah, in a way, right? Because what we do when we have a company that creates negative externalities in the world, if we're in a healthy political situation, which we're not, but if we were, right, and we have a company that creates negative externalities in the world, is we don't hesitate to either fine or punish or regulate for those negative externalities, right? And that's the job of the state. That's why these things should be
right.
fundamentally political, and that we should be interacting with Facebook and Google as citizens and demanding, once we articulate the problems and we debate it fully in public, we should demand the sort of responsible response from the state. Now,
isn't that what's going on right now, though? I mean, is that not?
Oh, no. We're getting noise, but we're not getting any regulation. Not really. Certainly not at the federal level, not in the United States.
These things take time. I mean, there certainly seems to be a current in the nation, as Scott Galloway says.
Well, I'm not giving up hope on it. I mean, California just passed a nice privacy law gets about halfway to what I would like. But
you don't address – we talk a lot on our shows, on all of our shows, about privacy, about surveillance capitalism, for want of a better term. You don't really address that issue in this book,
taking
our information to make money. That's not what this is about.
Well,
that's
a
separate
sense,
issue.
I take it as a given. I mean, I take it as a given, right? It's the nature of the business, right? You're not gonna have an advertising based business.
That's for another book,
that, right?
Yeah.
And Jeff and I have gone back and forth on Twitter in a very
Google as well. About Google,
complimentary way about the fact that Facebook does what Comcast does, and Facebook does better, right? In terms of like surveillance, what people often call surveillance capitalism. I tend to shy away from that phrase. I'm big on surveillance and short on capitalism, largely because I think it is an inherently pejorative phrase that describes a problem in the world, but it's once you have the responses and the dismissals become far too determined from the point of view of the speaker and the listener, right? If that makes sense. That's probably too complicated.
This is why
if you say surveillance capitalism and you know where the speaker stands, right? and so the response to the speaker is determined by that, right, by the stance rather than by the nature of the actual activity in the world. I'm not against the phrase. It's just not one I feel gets me anywhere.
It's
I think
unnecessarily
it puts me
negative.
On a rhetorical island,
This is just to say it again. This is why I respect Steven so much, is because he does pull back from. I mean, we're going to disagree about this, but he pulls back from that kind of. I would never accuse Siva of moral panic. Others I will, but not Siva.
Because
I have my moments.
I grew up in rhetorical island, and you may hear phrases like that from me.
I
don't understand. I'm not.
Well, two things, Siva. One is that I think that a lot of when I did the Intelligence Squared debate, I found myself not so much defending Facebook as attacking media a lot, saying everything you're complaining about, media have done. And media, thanks to the First Amendment, and I'm going to be all in favor of this, we do not try to regulate, and it does do what it does. And there's a Fox News out there, and this brings in the more pessimistic Postman than the more optimistic, I would say, McLuhan. And so a lot of the problem is the imported old media models, I think, and the attention economy. There's a lot of the same ills, and a lot of the causes of our bad country right now are not Facebook. In fact, I think for Donald Trump, you say right out, he didn't get elected because of Facebook, but Facebook helped a lot. As I was thinking about that after I read that from you, I thought, well, I'm not sure. I think maybe the Twitter, his Twitter voice with the amplification of media, I might argue, I'd love to see research done,
right,
had a bigger impact on the election.
That's an interesting question, though. I on the face of it, it makes sense, but that's because we all use Twitter. Twitter is a tiny 300 million users compared to 2 billion users.
The amplification of media. The fact that every single time, I argued the other day that the New York Times media should not be doing a story, which they do now. Every time Trump tweets, you know, The Hill writes a whole story about it.
Yep.
What publication should do, I think, is have a standing head that says what he tweeted today and just put it there. You got to do it, fine. But he the manipulation of Facebook, nobody's better at this than Trump.
Well, let me
ask. He doesn't manipulate Facebook. He manipulates media.
Let me ask that. If Hillary Clinton had been elected, would you still publish this book?
I had a very different book in mind.
well, that's interesting.
Yeah.
So I mean, maybe if you voted for Trump, that you're happy with Facebook.
No, I would not have been happy with Facebook. But it was a different book in this sense. And I had been working on it for a few years. It was a book to criticize the ideology of corporate social responsibility with that sort of argument I just made a few minutes ago. And out of that, Facebook was a chapter. Whole Foods was a chapter. Starbucks was a chapter. Google was a chapter.
Write that book, Stephen?
Phillips. And there were Pepsi was a chapter, right? I had this elaborate outline, a lot of research done on it. And it would have been a really helpful book for the Clintonian way of life, right? Where it's all about public-private partnerships and encouraging, you know, corporations to be responsible, right? That was the third way that, you know, Bill Clinton and later Hillary Clinton established themselves and have lived their lives. And that's, you know, that's their...
That's the story of the Clinton Foundation.
Right, yeah. And so, in a while, I'm a big supporter of them in a very sort of straight-up way. I have, as one should, serious criticisms of their way of doing things in the world, is any reasonable, intelligent person can vote for a person and still have issues, right? Of course, the positives were so much more significant than any whining I had. And that was the book I was going to write, right? So what happens November 8th, and I wake up the next day and I can barely hold my head up, and I feel so ashamed that I encouraged my then 10-year-old daughter to believe that there was going to be a woman president and that almost nothing could go wrong with that, right? And she's looking at me like, what the hell do you know? And I'm looking at me like, what the hell do I know? And here I have this, you know, PhD in American studies, and I clearly don't understand America. You know, like, what the hell? You know, and what good am I? I teach the America's elite young people who probably don't even need me to lead rich and full lives. Occasionally I write stuff that, you know, some people find interesting, but I felt so useless. I thought, why didn't I become an immigration lawyer? And for a couple of days, I actually thought, like, I should probably become an immigration lawyer. We might need a few. And I kind of feel that way again this month. I was, you know, like a lot of people, I was just feeling like, oh my God, what good am I? Like, there's some serious stuff coming down, and I am not like prepared to contribute in a core way. What can I do? And it took me a couple of weeks to figure out what I can do. And what I can do is try to explain a bit about what's going on in our media ecosystem, right? And so I really want people to start thinking about our media systems ecologically and as a complex system of interrelated parts that affect each other. You know, Trump tweets because it's the thing he knows how to use, even though he doesn't have a clue about it. He just knows how to do it. It goes out to the potential of 300 million Twitter users. We think a good portion of those are actually human beings.
Maybe and then, of course, as much Russian as half. Bots,
you know, amplified too. And then the tweets get reacted to, right? People like Jeff and I will say, whoa, this is a crazy tweet.
Yeah, that's who's
tweet
doing
the
amplification,
right?
Yeah.
Right. That happens. That amplification happens. And then, you know, Joy at MSNBC picks it up, and then it's on TV, and then and Fox sees it. MSNBC is making a big deal out of it. So then it's on Fox. But the thing is, Facebook is linked into all of that. Right. Facebook is constantly filled with clips from MSNBC, clips from Fox, clips from Twitter. Right. Facebook is so much bigger and so much more structured and reaches more people's daily lives. And it's where people are performing their politics in America and to a large extent beyond. Right. So this book is I decided to write a book if I wrote the book just about how Donald Trump used Facebook, it's a book that's worth something for a couple of years, maybe. But, you know, stuff would change so fast. It really would be like, why write a book about that? Right. There's no literally no shelf life to that story. But what I wanted to do was write a global book, because the way that Trump used Facebook, and I think this was often lost because Trump himself doesn't post to Facebook. He has people who do that. It's often forgotten that Trump's Facebook following is actually bigger than his Twitter following, especially in the United States. And that what he tweets ends up on Facebook, but it's also supplemented with what his team puts on Facebook. And it's, that stuff is really powerful and really important to keeping his base motivated, and in some cases trying to expand his base, although they're not big on that these days. During the campaign, you know, I mean, this is one thing that I think is should be really taken seriously. Brad Parscale, who has no reason to us, basically says we won because of Facebook, because they knew how to use Facebook in ways that the Clinton people didn't or didn't care to know, right? Clinton's team was filled with really smart professional experts with years of experience running campaigns in the United States of America. Trump's campaign had none of those people, right? Like Roger Stone was the only person who had any experience running a campaign at that level, right? And it was amateur hour for Trump. So they had, in a weird way, they had beginner's mind. So Parscale knows how to do Facebook marketing. That was his job for the Trump organization. He knows how to target ads. He knows how to A/B test. He knows how to create a bunch of people running eight to 20 different versions of an ad to run in Dade County, targeting Jewish women, run in Dade County, targeting African-American men, run in Dade County, targeting men of Haitian descent, right? I mean, that kind of surgical precision that is sort of, you know, regular, a day at the office for anybody who does social media marketing, was not something that occurred to the Clinton campaign as being crucial or central. So Clinton spent a lot of money on television in all the states that her polls told her were swing states, including Arizona, bizarrely, right? And spent no effort on either grassroots stuff or, just as importantly, Facebook targeting in states that she didn't ever question or her campaign never questioned, like Michigan and Wisconsin. And how does she lose the Electoral College with about 80,000 votes across those three states, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, Michigan? Well, a surgical strike will do that, right? It will move just enough voters to flip Wisconsin. We'll move just enough voters to flip Michigan. We'll move just enough voters.
There's kind of a precedent for this, though. Wasn't Dick Nixon the first to bring Madison Avenue into the presidential campaigns and succeeded as a result? Made Hubert Humphrey look like a loser.
The first time, he tried it first in 1960.
Didn't work in the 60 because he had a bad shave, I guess. And
he used Madison Avenue advertisers in a really professional way in 1960, but didn't use it as well as he did in 68.
Yeah,
now, of course, Nixon won in 68 for 100 reasons, including betraying our country and
destroying. Well, I think we might look back in history 20 years from now and say the same about the Trump victory.
Well, right. As I said in the book, there are 100 reasons why Donald Trump is president.
Just Facebook.
Jim Comey is one reason. Hillary Clinton's early run campaign is another. Trump's ability to stir up xenophobia and racism and misogyny is another.
Let's not forget Russia.
There are lots of little – any one of those things might have changed the result. Right. I mean, especially we're talking about 100,000 or 80,000 votes over three states. In Florida, it's 110,000 votes. Like, so narrow. A butterfly flaps its wings in Oregon and Hillary Clinton's president. It's so maddening. It's so many, right? So given that, that's why I don't want to say, I mean, I let Brad Parscale say we won because of Facebook.
Right.
I will step back and say, this is what Parscale says, right? Yeah. I will say that Facebook mattered to that campaign. And in other words, it was their central campaign tool.
Well, the other precedent, though, and you talk about it in the book, is the Arab Spring. And you talk about how in the early days, while Ghanem, you know, credited Facebook with their success and then had to say, well, it failed us as well.
So there's a couple things about the Arab Spring, and this is it started in January, for one thing. But but secondly, look, we saw massive street demonstrations everywhere from Casablanca in Morocco, Casablanca and Rabat in Morocco, all the way to Bahrain, and right up the crest of the Mediterranean, Lebanon, Syria. And these demonstrations were largely in response to two things: long and deep oppression and corruption by leaders of these countries, a general sense among the population that they had reached critical mass of frustration. And the key thing, and this was lost in a lot of the accounts in those times, the key thing was that the price of wheat in every one of those countries had quadrupled in the previous 24 months, right? So people were hungry and they were angry. And the governments in most of those cases had to stop subsidizing wheat. And so there were some serious life and death complaints. You also had the presence of Al Jazeera, which was able to show people in Morocco that people were in the streets in Tunisia. And that was a pretty powerful visual phenomenon. What you did not have in any of those countries were a large number of people using either Facebook or Twitter. That wasn't the case in 2011. Facebook had just gone into it, started publishing in Arabic in 2010. There hadn't been enough time for an Arabic base to build at that time. Twitter had even fewer, like a few thousand users in Egypt, almost all of them in Cairo. What Twitter and Facebook did for us outside of that region was give us insight in places where we didn't have reporters, where we could get testimony from activists, many of whom were cosmopolitan, many of whom, like Goman, spoke multiple languages. Goman actually, you know, he wasn't in Egypt at the beginning of the uprising.
He was in Dubai, right?
Yeah. And so, you know, he quickly got to Egypt once he realized that, you know, stuff was going down. But, you know, so look, what we had was a core in Egypt specifically, we had a core of activists who had been active for a long time, who were cosmopolitan in nature, who were focused in Cairo. And they certainly were using Facebook, especially across the diaspora, the Egyptian diaspora, to keep people engaged and organized. But they quickly realized two things. One, Facebook is a terrible place to organize an uprising against an authoritarian government because it's easy to watch stuff, right? It's real easy for government to figure out what's going on and to drop spies in, right? That's number one. And number two is that most of the people they wanted into the streets didn't have smartphones, didn't have Facebook, didn't even have internet access. They had SMS. And so they used SMS. And when you combine SMS with Al Jazeera, and you have this layer of cosmopolitan leadership using Facebook and Twitter to get the message out about what's going on, getting message out to communities in Paris and London and Montreal and New York, you know, so money can flow back and goodwill can flow back, et cetera. And you can impress reporters with what's going on. That's all important, but it wasn't crucial.
Is Facebook used today by terrorist organizations to recruit?
Well, so now it's a totally different story. Like if there was something going down in Egypt today, Facebook would be a big part of it. Because so many people now use Facebook in Egypt, right? Which wasn't the case in 2011. Is Facebook used for terrorist recruitment? Occasionally. YouTube is a much bigger phenomenon.
YouTube is bigger.
Yeah. So Facebook has actually been this is one thing that Facebook has filtered out fairly effectively over the past few years, is the sort of hardcore and obvious terrorist recruitments. Because in a lot of cases, first Al-Qaeda and later ISIS, it was so easy to screen for that stuff, and they knew where it was coming from, nonetheless the ideas flow through, right? You do have Islamist propaganda flowing through, like point to point ISIS recruiting propaganda doesn't generally flow through Facebook. What it does flow through, though, is WhatsApp, which of course
everybody I know in India, in Brazil, in Colombia, is very concerned about how WhatsApp is used.
That's right. And there's nothing Facebook can do about that.
Well, and if it weren't WhatsApp, it would be Telegram or it would be some other tool. I mean, it's not that there's, you know, you don't have to have a monopoly.
Encryption will be embedded and used.
Yeah.
Steve, you'll go ahead.
Go ahead. No, please, Jeff.
I was going to go to another. Okay. So I'd like to push you a little bit, Siva, on trying to go toward the solutions you envision. And you say at the end that you don't have them, and that's the proper thing to say. And
yeah, it's the most depressing conclusion I've ever read.
Really, but I don't believe it. I don't believe it.
It's okay. Like, so, just give up and go home, everybody.
Yeah, the book's over. So this is where I think we agree. I mean, where you and I disagree, I think primarily is over a matter of timing, right? You've heard my Gutenberg spiel. I think we're in very early days. I think we're just beginning to figure out what this technology can do. I think we're just beginning to negotiate our norms around it and our expectations around it, right? And I think that when I debated Roger McNamee and Franklin Foer, they're in full panic mode. You're not. You're in a more analytical mode. But I want to talk about the architecture that's possible here. I interviewed Deb Roy at MIT Media Lab, also tied to Twitter, and he was basically saying Facebook is already maximized to do what it does. Capitalistic companies have one or two simple metrics. That's how they run. They're built for that. That's it. You kind of can't change it. I don't know that I buy that. And you also say in the book that you fear Facebook's emphasis on groups now, and I get that if the groups are individual. But let me just try this out on you. I also posted that when Zuckerberg said that rather than having you waste time on stupid videos solely that get you depressed because it's like junk food, then no, we're going to emphasize meaningful interactions between people. And I argued back that that was a shallow and temporal definition of community. And I fear that we're going to move from clickbait to comment bait. And that it's what you said before. I'll put up something outrageous. Yeah. People will comment. The algorithm will think that I'm so friggin' smart. But here's finally the question. How it's possible to architect, to engineer some of the outcomes that are there. Do you know about Spaceship Media? Have you heard of them?
No, please tell me.
Okay, so let me give a second. I think I've told Leo about this in the past. So Spaceship Media, a couple journalists in San Francisco, and they've now expanded considerably, but their first test was to get 25 women who voted for Trump in Alabama, 25 women who voted for Clinton in San Francisco. Journalists interviewed them all, and then they put them into a Facebook group. And they first started talking about their family and all that was fine, but then very soon it descended. And they got into fights.
Was it moderated at all? Because we have talked about
that's
before.
The thing. Yes, the journalist was there, but the journalist wasn't there as a moderator. The journalist was there as a source. So the miraculous, beautiful thing that happened was that the participants came to the journalist and said, can you help us out over here? We're getting in trouble. Can you look up some stuff for us?
Oh, interesting.
Which tells me that the way I tell the story is the heavens opened up, the angels sang, and citizens cared about having an informed conversation. They trusted facts, and they trusted the journalist to get it for them because there was a relationship there, a different relationship. Yeah. So finally to the point, I think it's possible. And now Spaceship has a project which we help fund at NII, which also has some Facebook money, full disclosure, but they had no role in deciding this. We did with 5,000 women on Facebook. We'll see how well this scales, even though 5,000 is not a big scale, but does it go farther? So I argue that Facebook's opportunity and need, as is media's opportunity and need, is to make strangers less strange, to build bridges among communities. So the groups may be fine to gather with people you know, but how does Facebook and how do media build bridges across them? In my social journalism program, it's always about communities in plural, and the friction point of where they come is where the journalism is needed. So finally, can you imagine re-architecting Facebook in ways? And I take your point well that it's part of an ecosystem and there's economic motives that it's all that there. But if you were going to be able to sit back and just kind of simply say, what's a better Facebook? What would that be in your mind?
Yeah. So I would imagine that if Facebook could build out a group dynamic platform within its platform that resembles what you're discussing, we could see some nice things happen. Is that sufficient? That would be the question. So two things to think about here. What you've described works if it does work in the United States of America, where, as I said, we got off pretty easy right? Mm-hmm. Would that work in Myanmar? Would that work in Sri Lanka? Would that work in Kenya?
A lot tougher, right?
Would that work in the Philippines, right? Everything Facebook has been trying to do has mostly been cosmetic in the sense that it was designed to, let's make sure we keep the German election clean. Let's make sure that the Irish referendum on abortion is not invaded by fake accounts from Russia. Let's make sure that the U.S. election in 2018, which, oh my God, 435 congressional races, like how the heck are they doing that? I know that they're like pulling their hair out about it right now, right? Those sorts of interventions and this sort of, you know, building of better interfaces for deliberation is something I would think would be nice for Facebook to do. Would it actually attract people's interest and engagement, enough people over enough time in enough places in the world? I'm very doubtful about that. We're pretty.
This goes back to the prior point about whether you're how depressed you are about the state of mankind.
Yes. Well, yeah, but look, we're also you know, frankly, we're pretty stretched for time, and our attentions are pretty stretched. And someone who is engaging with Facebook in a village in the Philippines is getting a string of propaganda from the Duterte government and the Duterte campaign about how terrible X group or Y group is and how great Duterte is. And that is the sort of fulfillment of his media engagement, right? It's a much flatter, less diverse media ecosystem than what we have. In Myanmar, it's even worse because they, you know, Myanmar, they didn't have phone connections till 2014, and they don't have a newspaper or a, you know, a satellite television ecosystem even. So it's just Facebook, right? So in much of the world we're talking about a situation, is Facebook even going to build out those sort of systems in all of those languages, right? So when we talk about how Facebook is going to, and Facebook will talk about this, right, build machine learning systems or hire screeners in other parts of the world, I look at India and I say there are more than a dozen official languages in India. Yeah. Are you going to be able to hire thousands of people in Malayalam, thousands of people in Telugu, thousands of people who will speak Bengali and read Bengali and be able to flag the right derogatory terms for the other in each of those, right? And those things, it's unsolvable, that problem, right? I do like the fact that people are, and I know they are, using Facebook to the best of their ability to try to build relationships that are helpful and can actually enhance Republican values, smaller Republican values. Mm-hmm. Totally love that. I think also doing it in coffee shops and barbershops. We should be doing it across backyards. We should be doing it in churches. That's where the work is, right? So what I want to see is platform agnostic or platform agnostically, we should be saying, what institutions, norms, behaviors, and values do we want to build and reinforce across society in all these different areas, in all these different ways that we interact with people? How can we be better to each other? How can we recapture a sense of common fate that we're all in this? And we probably want to write and maintain rules and a rule of law in a way that, you know, doesn't take our subject position as the final answer, right? That we actually want a decent society. And what does it mean to have a decent society, right? To have that conversation, we have to start at first principles. We've taken this for granted way too long. Yes. So I think we need to invest in public libraries. We need to invest in public forums. We need to invest more in schools, more in universities, more in, I mean, this is a lovely conversation. I love talking to you guys. And every time I get the chance, I think we get somewhere, and I hope the people who listen get something out of it, right? These habits are important, and the technology is not as important as the habit, the will, and the commitment that we have to it.
Well said. But I think you also acknowledge that the institutions that are being challenged, that feel very challenged, also have bare blame here. They're finally hearing from people they couldn't hear from before. And that cacophony is democracy in an uncomfortable form, but it's democracy, and it's being manipulated. Take manipulation aside, there's a lot of people who are angry. They're fearful. They're ignorant. There's a lot of issues out there that go far beyond, and that our institutions have already kind of failed us in many ways, and that
Well, I think they've been designed to fail. I mean, there's been a 40-year campaign to undermine these institutions and make them fail. Yeah. And in this country and in Western Europe.
The irony of all this is that this Facebook thing is a pretty darn good tool to accomplish, probably better than universities and libraries, to accomplish exactly the ends you describe. But
wow.
It would then, is it not? But then it no. would require... It would then require somebody to some central power to say, well, this is how we're going to use Facebook.
So a couple of reasons why it's not.
That's where the tendency is going to end up being. And I fear that that's where we're going to go, to be honest.
I mean, its interface itself is basically incapable of handling the sort of.
You don't think Facebook could be. No, you don't need deliberation. You need a national mythos. You don't think Facebook could be used to create a shared common mythos that everybody would buy into, that everybody would gladly march into the future.
Facebook's not national. Facebook's global.
Well, yeah, right? It'd have to be global. Done. But let's just talk about the U.S.
You're right. You can't work. You can't design Facebook in one American way and not.
No, but right.
So, secondly, now, okay.
I mean, isn't that what Duterte has done? In effect, we may not agree with what his national mythos is, but has he not used Facebook quite effectively to do that?
That idea that would be Facebook's purpose would work against the very core idea of maximum engagement with and maximum attention with the items that flow on Facebook. That's what Facebook's designed to do. It's what it does so well. It's how it makes its money. It's what Facebook uses to say, hey, we did a great job. Look at the time used, the engagement, all that stuff, all those metrics. There's no way to measure. That sort of ethos, right? And you're asking Facebook to perform something that it doesn't have the calling to do, right? It owes its investors a return on investment. This is what the public is for, right? This is what public libraries are supposed to be. This is what public schools are supposed to be, or what public forums are supposed to be. We design those areas of public life to serve the public, and Facebook is a private institution.
Yeah, but so is Fox News, and so
it's not designed for that.
Television became that for us, and Fox News has done the same thing.
It really didn't. It didn't become that at all. Television delivers entertainment and for attention, and in some cases, it suspended its entertainment obligation to provide news and information. But even that's undermined to the point where. Most of the time, what you see on Fox News and MSNBC is a function of entertainment, in the sense of entertainment masked as information, where it's not about deliberation, and it's not about reaching any sort of common sense or common ground, and it's not about trying to figure out what we have as a common goal. And now I'm talking about even people I dig, right? Like Chris Hayes or Rachel Maddow. Like,
I'm not disagreeing with you.
They're in the business of riling me up so that before I get to bed, I'm all angry about how things are, right? That's their job. They do it for me. And I plug in every day to get that drug of indignation from them, right? And so
I'm not disagreeing with you, but if you get somebody like a Roger Ailes who says, well, why can't we use this to forward an agenda and succeed at it, or a Duterte who says, why can't we use these tools to forward an agenda and succeed at it? Those are the people who...
Yeah, I think Leo, your argument is persuasive when you say Duterte. He does it. The bad guys have shown how to use this wisely. The institutions and the good guys still try to draw people to their past.
Yeah, and I understand the argument. It'd be much better.
How can good guys use these tools?
It'd be much better if the good guys won, but they're not winning.
No, the bad guys succeed... In a shallow world,
okay.
In a world of shallow, fractured attention, right? The bad guys always win in a world of shallow and fractured attention, where we get a flow of stimulation across our screens, where we get
Facebook.
Can't hold onto a thought in any deep way. That's how they win. That's why they are all about the cacophony and all about the noise. The cacophony feeds authoritarianism.
Yes, that's kind of my point.
Yeah, we agree.
you quote your, I don't know if it's fair to say mentor, but Neil Postman, when you say, you talk about technopoly, the state of culture, a state of mind, it consists of the deification of technology, which means that the culture seeks its authorization in technology, finds its satisfactions in technology, and takes its orders from technology. And I fear that's where we are.
Right.
And in fact, I think you do too, because you say in the last sentence of this book, it's getting dark quickly.
And I didn't even know what the Supreme Court was going to do. So, yeah.
But that is not a reason not to read the book. It doesn't have a prescription because there is no easy prescription, to be honest. It's something we've been chewing on for the last few years on all of our shows and certainly on This Week in Google with Jeff. But I think this is the information you need to make a coherent, to think coherently about it.
And I want to be wrong. I mean, I want my pessimism to be motivation for people who are smarter and more creative than I am to show me that I haven't thought of responses, public responses, policy responses, or internal Facebook responses that I haven't thought it all through, right? And that I could be wrong. In fact, I would love to be wrong. I would love to come back on the show in 3 years, 4 years, 5 years, assuming we still have a democracy, and say, boy, no one should buy that book. I was so wrong.
I was so wrong.
You know, if I could be that wrong, I would be a very happy man.
I would wish that Facebook would be wise enough to invite you out and have a discussion. I mean, I wrote the kiss-ass book about Google, and they have me out to a book thing. I don't think – did Google ever invite you out for a book?
No,
book?
They haven't. No.
Steve's book was on the Googleization of everything, and perhaps not as popular within the – walls of Google.
Yeah, you won't be surprised to know that Microsoft's been really happy about both of them.
Here's as long as we're homing in on the sad stuff, here's another sad story. It sounds like the solution has to come from within Facebook. With people like Cory Doctorow and others have talked about, well, maybe we need a new Facebook. We need a federated Facebook, a Facebook that is not based on advertising or surveillance capitalism. But it sounds like that's not the solution either. That the solution has
I can't
to really-
imagine. Can you imagine the venture capital? Capitalist who says, yeah, here's $19 million. Right. Get going on the thing that's going to displace Facebook without gathering people's data, without targeting advertising. Like, how's that money going to come to you, right? I mean, it's so naive to think that we can create a money machine to compete with Facebook that would convince everybody and their cousin and their mother and their cousin's cousin to quit Facebook and come over to this other thing.
But right? is it not the case that Facebook is not winning with people under 25, that they don't choose to use Facebook?
In the United States of America, that is true. But they decide to use Instagram, which is owned by Facebook, so Facebook doesn't care. Now, that doesn't mean they will never use Facebook, right? We don't know what decision they will make at 21, 22 when their college graduating class distributes themselves around the country and they want to be in constant contact and follow them as they have kids and puppies and have kids graduate from college, right? Because that's fundamentally why we're all on Facebook, to keep up with our cousins' kids and their kids' kids and you know when someone's ill and know when someone has passed away. That's the good stuff. That's why 2.2 billion people are on Facebook. We're not fools, right? And given that, there are reasons why an adult finds Facebook valuable, and there are reasons why a teen finds Facebook not so interesting, and there are reasons why Instagram is pretty great for everybody, actually, I think. And if Facebook were more like Instagram, I wouldn't have written this book. But look, Instagram is owned by Facebook, so every minute you spend on Instagram, you click on their ads, that's money in the pot of Facebook, so they're happy with it, right? That's one thing. But again, it's only North America. Facebook growth among young people is astronomical everywhere but North America. 220 million Americans use Facebook today. 250 million people in India use Facebook.
Yeah.
That's a quarter of the population of India. And India is so much younger than the United States of America. You know, Kenya is younger. Brazil is younger. Morocco is younger. Turkey is younger. The rest of the world is so much younger than America and Western Europe. So all of these new Facebook users are very young. And that is where the growth is. That's where the future is. Not only is the future of Facebook in India, the present of Facebook is in India. So we really have to break out of our American-only conversation about Facebook.
That's a very
And I also
point.
Think, Leo, that if you buy my Gutenberg 1474 argument, then you know, what we see so far are analogs to things we know in some form or another. And who knows what is yet to come? I can imagine someone coming along. I mean, I can imagine trying to change Facebook to make it more community oriented and bridge building. But maybe that's just stupid. I think that was what Deb Roy was trying to argue with me. But I can see someone coming along and thinking the mistake people make when they have this discussion is And I'm glad you pointed out the fallacy of Tristan Harris's view that let's just get rid of advertising, everything will be okay.
Right.
Doesn't give anyone any motive to do anything, any incentive. But I can imagine someone, you know, the Scott Heiferman who made Meetup as a reaction to Bowling Alone and did something that that enables communities to get together, right? I can imagine new generations of uses of a connected world that might act as a ballast to Facebook. I think Google may well be around forever. Facebook itself recognizes that it has to buy Instagram and it has to buy WhatsApp because it's a generational thing. The other thing about it is that Google has a much easier job. Information, as it turns out, is a lot cleaner, even when there's propaganda on it. People are messy, and Facebook chose to get in the people business.
They both have a long-term game that gets beyond their original mission, and that game is to become the operating system of our lives, right? So that's why Google wants to manage the data that flows through our cars and our clothes and our houses. And Facebook would like to get in the virtual reality business. It is already. It would like to be the master of that form of interaction. That has all sorts of dangers, by the way, which is one of the reasons I think that the Oculus Rift purchase might actually be more significant than the Instagram purchase down the line. But I think that you know, these companies, along with Amazon and Apple and Microsoft, they all know that the way they made money in the last 10 or 20 years is not how they're going to make money in the next 20 years. And they want to be the operating system of our lives because everything can have data flowing through it if they wish it and if we go along with it. And if that's the case, for such systems to work, there's going to have to essentially be a monopoly or a duopoly for there to be standardization across these systems. They're going to have to be secure systems. We can't have open systems. So whatever we thought the internet was back in 1995 or 2000 or even 2005, that's long gone.
The you sense think openness of open, is doomed?
Is oh, yeah, totally, doomed? It's over. It's so totally over.
Oh, God. I'm so depressed. One last question, Siva. Are you on Facebook?
I am. Yeah. I am. Why? Because, well, two reasons. I would be committing professional malpractice if I did not
I guess you're
constantly
right.
understand how Facebook works, right?
Yeah. That's my justification.
Secondly, I'm into the puppy photos, and I like to know when my cousin's kids are graduating from college. Like, all the good reasons that we use Facebook. Yeah. It's why I got on in the first place.
Yeah.
Those things have not gone away. It's also really good for promoting a book and urging people to buy my book, right?
And brainwashing.
It's a great advertising platform as well, right? So, I'm like Jeff. Like Jeff taught me early on how to be savvy in this world. I'm good at it. Not everybody is. I don't want to pretend that everybody is in my position in the world. So I also take vacations. I take breaks from it. If I have a writing deadline, for instance, I will take a few weeks off. If I find myself being really nasty to people on Facebook or Twitter, I will suspend my account and cool down for, 2 weeks to 2 months.
I've been doing the same thing, but not if I'm nasty. If I start feeling bad after checking out Facebook, I deactivate. And I'm currently in the deactivated state.
Deactivates. But the quit Facebook movement I thought was self-indulgent. Apolitical, and
you say,
basically,
if everybody who privilege. Reads this book quit Facebook, no one would notice.
That's right. I'm not going to sell 2.2 billion books, right?
I wish.
I'm not even going to sell 220 million books. I'd be lucky if I sold a few hundred thousand books. And if 220 million Americans use Facebook, if 2 million people quit Facebook,
nothing.
Facebook would shrug.
Nothing.
Oh, we went from 220 million to 218 million in the United States.
Yeah.
We'll wait 6 months and we'll make up that in India. Yeah, exactly. Right. So, I mean, granted, American consumers are more important to revenue than Indian consumers. That might change in 10 years. So, those are important things to remember. It's like this idea that we can mount effective political action by putting a hashtag on something and whining and then standing up and saying, I'm too good for this. That's not real. And it's not even a real boycott. I think it's an insult to the actual effective boycotts that we've seen in the history of social movements that involve real sacrifice. you know, and, right. and real risk and real coordination.
It's very easy
and
to
denying
boycott Facebook.
A company yeah. revenue, right? Yeah. We're not, I don't write checks to Facebook. If I stop using Facebook, Facebook doesn't miss any money.
Right.
If I were an advertiser, right? If I were Procter & Gamble and I said no more Facebook, that would be a thing. But what are the chances of that?
You know, the real reason that that I follow Siva?
Why?
He's got the greatest dog.
I do. And in fact, she's Butter's Golden great. Butter 2013 on Instagram.
Well, this is a conversation that's just begun. It's interesting because the conversation is clearly now starting to focus on Facebook. You know, there's some Twitter and there's some Google in this. But really, it's about Facebook. And this is a great way to begin your quest to find out more. Anti-social media. How Facebook disconnects us and undermines democracy. It's from Oxford University Press. Siva Vaidyanathan is a professor of media.
I paid more than that for it.
You could have bought it on Amazon and put your local bookstore out of business.
Jeez.
So
I do need more reviews.
Actually, maybe Amazon is the next book because, we'll see.
Oh, yeah, but can you imagine trying to sell a book that criticizes Amazon?
My point exactly. Now who's the real power in the world? Thank you so much for being here, Siva. And thank you, Jeff Jarvis, for taking time.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
It's a
pleasure and an honor to talk with Siva and learn from him. Yeah. So I'm delighted to be here.
You catch Jeff, cool. of course, every Wednesday on This Week in Google, 1:30 Pacific, 4:30 Eastern, 20:30 UTC, where this conversation will certainly go on.
Yeah.
And Jeff is a professor of journalism at the City University of New York. I'm not going to read your whole long title. We'll save that
but
for
now. The Craig Newmark Graduate School of Journalism at the City University of New York.
Nice. Thank you. Yeah. Really Congrats. A great conversation. Yeah. Thank you both for being here today. I appreciate
Thank
it.
You, yeah. Thank you, Steve.
Thank you, Leo.
Take care. We do triangulation normally every Friday. Sometimes it's different times depending on our guest schedule, but we try to do it around about 3 p.m. Pacific, 6 p.m. Eastern, 2200 UTC every Friday. If you want to watch it live, and if you do, join us in the chat room, because the chat room is very important to this show, irc.twit.tv. But you can always get a copy of it on demand at your leisure and listen whenever you feel like it. Audio and video available at twit.tv/TRI or wherever you subscribe to podcasts. And I hope you will subscribe, because we're actually going to interview the author of Surveillance Capitalism in a couple of weeks, I think. And a lot more conversations around these subjects coming up on Triangulation. Thanks for being here. We'll see you next time. Bye-bye.